Hello and welcome. Scare track. Scare Track Podcast.
Welcome to the Scare Track Podcast, the UK's first podcast dedicated to the scare attraction and haunted house industry. However, please be advised that we have no censor. The language used may be of an explicit nature and is not intended for younger listeners or the easily offended. All views expressed are those of the individual host and do not necessarily reflect those of Scare Track, our guests, or any of our associates. So, if you're still here, let's get scared.
So this is where our adventure begins.
Oh my God! Ah! I'm scared myself!
Kate Monroe is screaming. Spoiler alert, freaking awesome.
The
quality of the set was amazing.
Oh, I don't like it.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Scare Track Podcast. My name is Mikey and today's episode is an interview episode with the undead ringmaster of the Circus of Horrors, Dr. Hayes. We get him onto the Scare Track Podcast to talk all about the 25 years of Circus of Horrors. That's right, they are celebrating their 25th anniversary this month. Myself and Hannah have seen the Circus of Horrors numerous times, whether it be at theatres, Tullers Shocktoberfest, ScareCon, Bikefest, all around the UK, and it's always a fantastic, ever-changing show that brings fantastic illusions, some amazing rock and roll music, crazy circus acts, a little bit of language, and a good bit of nudity as well. So, of course, it's right up my street. So, without any further ado, let's take you to the interview with myself, interviewing Dr. Hayes from the infamous Circus of Horrors.
You're listening to Scare Track.
Hello and welcome back to this episode of the Scare Track Podcast. Like I said in the intro, I am joined by Dr. Hayes, the undead ringmaster of the Circus of Horrors. Dr. Hayes, thank you so much for coming on to the Scare Track Podcast.
No problem, looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's really great to get you on. We've spoken very briefly from time to time throughout the years, whether it be at shows or a few scare cons as well in the past. But I thought chatting to you about the two sort of industries with scare entertainment and the Circus of Horrors, they sort of intertwine just that little bit, don't they?
Yeah, they certainly do. I mean, we've, for the last few years, performed at scare attractions, you know, over the... Yeah. Over the Halloween period, you know, we did one in Chepstow. We did Fright Nights at Thorpe Park. Yeah, and then the last few years, we've done two, really. We've done one in Blackpool Pleasure Beach. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we've done Tully's Shocktoberfest, which I think is an amazing event.
Oh, absolutely fantastic. Yeah, definitely. It's really one of the leaders in the UK scare industry, absolutely. And you guys down there have that awesome big top all set out as well. I've seen it the last few years down there. So it's great that you're not just on stage in theatres. Obviously, this is when there's no COVID-19 around, and we'll discuss that in a second. But it's great that your show, your performances can adapt. And I was reading on your website, you know, last October you had four different shows running at once, whether it be in theatres or Tullers Shocktoberfest. Is that something that is quite exciting? It means that you're not just doing the same thing every single tour, every single month. It just mixes it up a bit for you.
Well, exactly. I mean, when we do a festival, for example, if we do Glastonbury or Download, we do it in a big top. We'll run a stage at one end of it.
Right.
And we play to a huge capacity, you know, like 11,000 people a show, which is amazing.
Absolutely.
And we'll do like four shows in there. So it's, you know, you're being seen by loads of people all in one hit. And you do like a half an hour version of the Circus of Horrors, all Blood and Thunder, just one hit at it. Glastonbury, we tend to do it in the round, in a big top again, but in the round. And as you said, Tully's we do in the round as well. But then we can easily transform from that to a more conventional stage festival setting or a theatre proscenium march setting. And that is great because it keeps you on your toes and it makes it makes life a lot more interesting.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's great as an audience member as well. I'm a little bit of a theatre geek. So I like going to different theatres and seeing how each show can be performed. And like you say, if it's Thrust, End On, Proceeding March, in the round. And especially when there's a show such as yourself, like I say, I'm a fan of the show, so I've seen it in lots of different settings. as an audience member, it just adds that extra dynamic as well. So it's great that it's, you know, it's cool for yourself and the performers, but also for an audience member as well. In fairness, if anyone's listening to the Scare Trap podcast, I guarantee they know the Circus of Horrors. But in case we have a few new listeners, how would you describe the absolute craziness of what has been the last 25 years of the Circus of Horrors?
Well, it's an alternative rock and roll circus, and it all began really because I had sort of three loves in life, artistic loves in life, because maybe more than that, you know. Horror, because I was a kid of the 70s, really, and this is what did it all for me, really. And in the 70s, I was brought up in a circus, so I loved traditional circus. I was I loved the music of the 70s. I think it was a really, when I look back at it, it was an amazing time for music. If you look back at the early 70s and look at the amazing bands that produced, you know, I was a big T-Rex fan, but as well as that, the glam bands were brilliant, you know, Slade and the Sweet and people. Than David Bowie, Elton John, Rod Stewart, but then the metal bands as well, Zeppelin, and AC/DC, and whatnot, all of them, and it was just an amazing time for music, and not, you know, not only was it producing all this music, but these bands were number one in the charts. Yeah. You never see music like that dominating the charts, and so the album charts were dominated by the metal bands, and T-Rex also did well in the album charts, and then they also had loads and loads of hit singles. And then, you know, towards the end of the 70s, there was a bit of a lull in the middle when ABBA and 70s disco lot tried to hijack it, nearly ruined a decade. But thankfully, the punks come back and kicked it into touch, and we ended the decade on a high again. At the same time, so I was growing up with all of that, and at the same time, so that inspired me rock and roll, but at the same time, the horror movies changed significantly in the 70s.
Yeah.
You'd gone from your sort of traditional Frankenstein and Dracula type things, which were great, and I still love watching them, but you'd gone into a much more sinister thing, like, you know, The Exorcist, which is my favourite film,
course,
and
yes.
Carrie, and The Omen, and
The Shining,
Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Yeah, all of those, you know, all coming out of the 70s again, and it was like, wow, this is a, you know, a great time to growing up, and I suppose all these things influenced me. So when I gave traditional circus up, when I was a sort of, I suppose about 1979 or 78, I gave it up, and then joined a band that it was automatically a very theatrical band.
Yeah,
and that over the years turned into, you know, morphed into the Circus of Horrors. Yeah, so answer your question, what it is? It's an alternative rock and roll circus which mixes rock and roll. Bizarre, you know, or I suppose it's heavy metal really, but bizarre and unusual circus acts, but also with beautiful circus acts. I thought you'd see at Cirque du Soleil, but these are all given a horror twist. I mean, a lot of our artists actually go on to work for Soleil or have worked for Soleil and come to us. So it's, you know, you've got a very high quality of acts in there as well. So it's a mixture of all of that, and then, of course, tongue-in-cheek horror, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you're going to tell me you're going to go to a show and there's going to be, you know, some heavy metal, rock music, some awesome illusions, some crazy circus acts, like you say, some beautiful circus acts, and there might be a little bit of nudity in there as well, with a bit of bad language, you know you're set for a good night, 100%. And it's good that you mentioned, obviously, you've been to circus your whole life, I understand, and you had to learn how to spit fire when you were 12 years old, is that right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I had a little haze in my early years, because I was born and bred in a circus. My mum and dad obviously in the circus just after, when I was born, really, and then went off with a circus that summer, and my dad decided to do a runner and leave us and left me and my mum and a little dog in a van, not even a caravan, but a van in Wick, right up in Scotland. And we were on our own in the field, there was nobody there, and we were doing the advanced publicity for the circus, and he just up and went. Anyway, the circus people luckily looked after us and kept us till the end of that season and gave my mum a little bit of work and gave us some money to keep us going, you know. And then at the end of that season, took us to Preston in Lancashire, which is where I was brought up.
Yeah.
You know, I had a great childhood there, really. I really enjoyed growing up in Preston. And when I was about 11, my mum tried to sue my dad for maintenance. And the courts, in all their wisdom, said, well, why don't you get back together again? So they did. They got back together again in London. I hadn't met my dad, really, apart from when I was 6 months old. So I didn't know what he looked like or anything. And in the interim, in this 11-year gap, he'd had a really severe motorbike accident, and wow. His leg bent on his thigh rather than at the knee, so it was really weird. Okay. And one leg was longer than the other, and he was he'd had 5 heart attacks in 3 days. So he wasn't a fit man, but not a nice guy either. Anyway, within a month of settling down in a bedsit in London, when we arrived on the station, in Euston Station, we had nowhere to live, just me, my mum and my dad and some suitcases, and nowhere to live. And he found us a bedsit that we went and moved into. And within a month, though, he got itchy feet again and decided to go to the circus, but take us with him this time, or take me with him. And yeah. So he'd sold us this, he'd basically persuaded the circus in Ireland that we did this amazing fire-eating act, and I'd never even lit a match in my life, let alone fire it, and everyone wouldn't let me. And so all of a sudden, but there's no internet in those days, so they just had to take your word for it. He persuaded them that it was a good act, so off we went to Ireland, arrived over there, and stood in a circus ring, pretended I'd been a fire-eater for all my life, and really I was doing it for the first time. So I just did it. I had no fear. I just did it and carried on. Then within 2 years, my dad decided to do a runner yet again. But by then, this was the early 70s now, and I had sort of sawdust in my veins by then. So I decided to stay in a circus and stayed there and got all these inspirations from Mark Bolan and, you know, The Exorcist and everything else, Alice Cooper, you know, all that sort of stuff. And then early 80s really, left the circus and decided to have a bash at rock and roll, and that's what I did.
And a bash you did. Like, I mean, I've got a couple of your albums, your latest ones with The Interceptors from Hell, and I'm not just saying this because I've got you on, but it's always on in the car, because it's good. The kind of music that is just good classic style rock music, which can be used not only just as music and melody in itself, a fantastic melody, but it works really well with the circus as well. Like I say, it's a mixture of stuff when you're performing a show. So bring it over to the music side of things. Do you write for the show now, or does the show come after you've written a song? How does the process work?
No, in the main, I write for the show. I basically have an idea of an act and a theme. And I'll write a song with that theme in mind and with that particular act in mind. I'll think this will work really well with this act, and I'll write a song specifically for that. And then what happens, but I tend to only write a bit of the song. I might write a couple of verses and a chorus. I very rarely finish a song. Then we'll tend to go out and take it on tour and do it in the show. So we might do a bit of it in the show, but not necessarily the whole song. And then when I go to record it, then I want to turn it into a real song, a studio song. So then we'll write the rest of the verses, a different middle eight, and all the choruses, tighten them all up. So that's how it works now. And when we release albums, they're usually songs that we have played in the show. There's very few that have never been played in the show on the album. So, so that's how we do it. And again, my influences, what I've always liked is I always liked rock music, but I've always liked melody. Yeah. And people like Mark Bolan have great melodies in his music. I now like people like Rob Zombie, who, again, although it's very heavy metal, there are great melodies running through it. Alice Cooper, again, it's metal with melody. And, Motley Crue, metal with melody. That's the sort of stuff that I really like. You know, really good songs, really good tunes. And there's not many good songwriters around anymore, I'm afraid to say. A lot of the charts are dominated by dross, really.
Yeah.
Rubbish.
It takes about 50 people to write and produce one song.
And you never know who's really written it anyway, you know. Yeah. And they don't sell records anymore. I mean, T-Rex was selling 60,000 records a day.
Wow.
A day. Now, a lot of bands would love to sell that in their career.
Oh, of
let
course.
Alone in the day.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what they were selling in their height. You know, they had like 4 singles a year, and while those singles were in the charts, 60,000 records a day were being sold. It's just unbelievable that the difference that's happened now, and how much people were influenced by music in those days, and how sadly they're not as influenced in music now.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say there were real movements with music, in the past. I'm lucky that my uncle, he heavily educated me when it comes to good music, especially rock music. I whenever I go to his house, I get out his old record player and I get out the Judas Priest and Kiss and Guns N' Roses and Iron Maiden on the old school vinyls.
Yeah.
And it was the stuff that... what you remember from your childhood or growing up or your work is it's music. And he always has great memories of going to, it was the Monsters of Rock Festival back then. And so you can see, obviously, how music has influenced the world, obviously, through the 70s and 80s specifically, and very heavily has been an inspiration for you when it came to creating the Circus of Horrors in 1995 at Glastonbury. Is that why, do you reckon you have quite a good relationship with these festivals, especially Download Festival, because it's so rock heavy and friendly, and it's such a great atmosphere? Would you say because you started at Glastonbury and you were into the music, that's why the Circus of Horrors goes down so well at these music festivals?
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons we do well in theatres as well, I think, because you've got theatres like A Good Musical, don't they? And although we're heavy metal, it's still, it's still a music that a lot of people like. And when you go to Download and everything, we're doing predominantly original songs. There's only maybe one or two covers in the set. So nearly all original. So they don't necessarily know all the songs that when you play the Download, but they're loving it just as much, So I think, music is a vital part of the Circus of Horrors history and future.
Yeah, absolutely, definitely. And it, like you say, if you can do a kick-ass performance with these amazing acts and illusions and whatnot, having a quality sound piece to accompany that, just it's the icing on the cake, really, isn't it?
I'm very proud of it. When I listened back at it, we did... because there's no Download this year, but they invited us to do a piece on Download TV. We basically used a bit from one of our videos and another, an extract from one of our videos, which is about 10 minutes long, and then an introduction by myself, and then a little highlights edited video afterwards. Mm. And, I hadn't watched it for a while, the video, and when I watched it, I was thought, wow, this is really good. I'm not just acting this myself. It sounded, the music and everything sounded really kicking, and I thought, wow, this is really great, and it made me really proud of it, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's why you have such a fantastic fan base. That I see, obviously, on your social media, I see lots of people that are very big fans of you. I mean, at my local bank, I know the lady in there goes to every single show you do in the Midlands, whether it be Wolverhampton, Lichfield, Garrick.
Oh, great.
I'm in Telford, so we go to Oakengates Theatre to watch you, the Theatre 7. So you have a core fan base, and obviously that's because of a fantastic show, the music, and the impact that it can have on people. The first time I visited or watched one of your shows many years ago now, I wasn't entirely sure what I was going to watch, and now I think I've got three hoodies, two albums, your book. So it's quite infectious. That's probably the word to use. It's an infectious piece of art and theatre when it comes to the Circus of Horrors. And it's not just the UK, is it? You've gone around Europe, but obviously the US, the world. You were the first circus to go to Russia, is that right?
That's correct. We haven't actually done the US. I'd love to do that. We've been offered Vegas.
Yes, that was it. Sorry,
And I didn't do it because it was a hell of a risk.
Of
in Vegas, they do this thing called a four-wall deal where you can hire the venue. And the deal itself is fine. You'd say, that's not bad. I'd take a risk on that. But then when you look at the cost of visas to take your artists across,
and
the way I thought it would work if you took this crazy rock and roll circus from England over to, or from the UK, over to America. I think that's what they'd really like. They love it, the English, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you did that, this crazy rock and roll circus come over from England, I think that would have really worked. So if I hadn't taken a British band, and if I hadn't taken British artists or European artists, it wouldn't quite have been the same if you're just hiring people from America to almost franchise the show. So I wasn't quite as keen to do it, and I just thought I wanted to do it, but the cost, visa over there is not bad, it's £200,
mm-hmm.
but you have to have an attorney to get a visa, and that's £2,000, and that's per person.
Crikey.
So if you're looking at a cast of 20 odd people, and the flights to Vegas, and you're doing it all on a risk, and
big
you've got
risk,
to get accommodation for everybody, because it's not like you're using local people who might live in Vegas, and they come over, and they've already got somewhere to live. You're actually having to accommodate everybody.
Absolutely, yeah.
So it was just, for me, it was just too much of a risk. So it's not a case of never, you know, case of never say never, but I'd want someone to take that risk with me rather than me doing my own. But absolutely. No, we've done South America, ironically, yep. Japan a couple of times, Hong Kong, all over Europe, Finland, and as you quite rightly said, the only British circus ever to perform in Moscow yeah. or Russia.
See, you can't. That's some fantastic accolades there for the show in itself. And I know individuals within your shows have done like world record attempts and things like that as well. So you are, you know, the world famous or the infamous circus of horrors that, you know, it's well traveled, and we're proud to say that it's a UK based sort of production that, you know, it's British rock music, and but it's a very diverse amount of acts that come over and perform within the Circus of Horrors, isn't it?
Yeah, I try and bring different ones all the time, really. I've got the stable ones like Hannibal Helmer to the Sword Swallower. He's been with me quite a few years now, but he does vary his act, and you know, he's not swallowing the same sword every time. There's always different twists and turns to it. So I tend to use, you know, people like Hannibal Helmerto and Anastasia the Fourth Hair Hanging. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of the other acts I'll tend to bring in. I brought a fantastic half man in last year. Well, I've had him for 2 years now. And I found him in Russia, and he was performing at the Olympics, you know, the thing before it.
The opening ceremony,
yeah. And he was performing at that. I thought, bloody hell, this is amazing. They didn't make anything of the fact that he had no legs. Right. But he was there actually doing these amazing acrobatics and things. And then somebody sent a video of him so I could see it clearer. And, you know, this amazing ability, because he had no legs, and because he was determined to, you know, in life to see his goal. His goal was, when he was a kid, he didn't have a lot of money. He brought up with his mum and dad, no legs. And and he went to a circus and loved it. They took him to a circus, and he said, I want to be in the circus. And of course, they said, no, you can't possibly do that, Victor. But he did. He was determined, and he taught himself and got this amazing upper body strength. And because he's got no legs, he developed this, as I say, this amazing strength. And he does these amazing acts. And what we wanted to do, of course, is chop his legs off in true horror fashion.
Of course.
And then his torso would then continue to do these amazing circus acts, you know, aerial acts and acrobatics and all sorts of stuff. And he's a great guy. He's really good fun and a good lad to have around. You know, we really enjoy him.
Yeah, absolutely. That's an act that I definitely need to see. I mean, like I said, I've watched the show over the years, and it does, you know, it changes up a little bit. Like you say, you have your staple characters like Hannibal and Anastasia. I know the evil twins and whatnot have been with you at a fair few gigs as well. So, you do also see people sort of come and go and whatnot. What's the sort of pro? Because it's got to be a difficult one. It's not like an ad at the local job centre. I need a sword swallower. I need someone that can hang by their hair. How does that process sort of work? Are you obviously friendly with other circuses? Do you swap and trade acts? How would you?
I don't really shop and trade. I mean, basically, it's the age-old adage, really. Everybody wants to run away and join the circus. I guarantee if I put something on social media now to say, right, we're back going again, we need no acts, I bet you anything I'd have 1,000 emails within a day.
Wow.
I'm not joking. I can't get through them all. They tend to, I tell them not to send them on Facebook Messenger. They always do. right. And I keep saying, don't do that. Send them on an email so I can really see them clearly.
Of course.
And I want a video link, and you'd be amazed how Facebook Messenger. I did it last year because when we were doing the four shows at the same time, I did a lot of extra acts, even if it was only for that 1 month over Halloween.
Yeah.
And I did that same sort of ad, and it took me a month to get through all the people who'd applied on Facebook Messenger, because there was just so many. It's unbelievable. So it's not difficult to get people. The difficult thing now, of course, is what effect COVID will have on us. And
of course,
it's having a massive effect on the entertainment and leisure industry and tourism all over the country, really. Yeah. And we're just one part of that. But we've been hit probably as bad as airlines, I think, because circuses and theatre, I mean, they've now said theatres can open again, but not with live performance. A lot of people say, what doesn't make any sense? What they say, never. Well, I'll tell you why they're saying that. So it gives the theatres a chance to make some money by putting films in there if they want.
Yeah.
If they want to turn it into a cinema, and operate with a lot less people coming to see them with social distancing, but they could still take some money. So that's the reason they've done that, and it's because of the saliva that you project from your mouth if you're singing or shouting loudly or talking loudly, which tends to be the case in theatre. So I think it's going to be a bit of a slow process for us, but all being well, we'll overcome it, and we've got a few clever ideas up our sleeve that that might work.
Yeah, absolutely. I've definitely got the my fingers crossed. I work in the leisure industry, and my wife is in the hospitality industry, and obviously yourselves with Life Theatre. I think we're on that list of the last ones back to work, unfortunately.
It was always going to be, really, sadly, because we are mass gatherings at the end of the day.
Absolutely.
You can't. If they said you can open, but you can only have 200 people to show, well, we just wouldn't earn enough money from that.
I was going to say, yeah, and it's a business at the end of the day. Like mentioning back to the Las Vegas deal, not only are you're the ringmaster, you're a songwriter, show producer, director, you're the guy that runs a business at the end of the day, and you need to make sure that all the money adds up. And if you're doing a show in front of 200 people, then that's not gonna make the money, is it?
It's not. That's the problem. Yeah. So, and theatres know that too, and so they don't want to open the doors for only 200 people. You know, so we've just got to find a way around it. I mean, until they find a vaccine, there might not be a permanent way around it. But let's all hope. You know, it's definitely getting better.
Yes, definitely.
By the day, you look at the figures dropping and the amount of people with coronavirus and the amount of people dying with it, definitely getting better. So I feel for all these poor families who have had people die. And
absolutely.
So, a friend of mine's mum died with it, but she was 98 years old.
Same. You know. My wife's granddad died, but again, he was very ill in his mid-80s. Yeah. You know, it's no excuse. It's not to say that's okay, but I can, again, this virus is not nice, but it's not the plague, is it? It's affecting older and vulnerable people. But
the one thing in our favour really is the fact that generally in our shows it's younger people who come. Mm-hmm. It is quite diverse. You do get a mixture of sort of 15, 16 year olds wanting to come up to mainly, I suppose, 40 or 50, but you do get some over that age, you know. Yeah. And I suppose but the majority of them are relatively, you know, younger people, so that's one advantage we have.
Yes, especially the likes of, you know, festivals are a whole different ball game, because that is mass gatherings, you know, to the max. But I'm pretty certain the Doghouse at Download is that slightly younger demographic as well, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I suppose it's forced you to actually have your first day off in 25 years, though.
Yeah, you know something, though, I'm working harder, really, on admin than I have done for ages, because
I bet.
What's really difficult is I'm trying to book all theatres for the future, because if I don't do it, other people will. And consequently, while I'm doing it, half the theatres aren't open. So you're forever emailing and ringing people who aren't there. I have, unbelievably, nearly got the whole tour booked. I've nearly got 100 venues booked from November through to the end of March. But you know full well that some of them are going to go to the wayside, I'm afraid to say. Some won't survive, and some will want to change the dates because they won't have enough time to promote it. So I know a lot of the ones that are already booked are going to get changed again. We lost 12 shows at the end of last tour, as well as all the festivals. So that was a nightmare in itself. We did manage to reschedule every single one, which is great. But you're sort of rescheduling and hoping you don't have to reschedule for a second time.
Well, that is. I've had a few, like I said, I quite enjoy the theatre. I've had a few shows that have been rescheduled twice already. I was coming to see you guys at Oaken Gates.
Yeah.
And then I think it was 5 days before I was due to see you. That's when they said theatres are closing.
That's exactly right. It was going to be, I think it was our next show. We finished on, we did one weekend. We did St. Albans. It was the last show, which was not intended to be. And then we had 3 days off, and then we were due to come to Telford and do another run, which took us to the end of the season. And, of course, the very next day after St. Albans, the Prime Minister said that he didn't say all theatres are going to close now, but he did say all place of mass gatherings of, you know, can't carry on. Yeah. So he left it for the theatres to do it themselves. But yeah,
he did that with us. He said with pubs and sort of play centres and leisure centres. He didn't actually close us, but he's told people to stop coming.
Yeah, a week later he did. I think he gave people a chance to do it themselves.
To slowly
and
do it.
Nearly every theatre did do that. There's one or two that didn't, but almost all of them did. And as I say, within a day, that happened on Monday, and on Tuesday, I'd, out of the 12, I'd confirmed about 8 of the other ones, rescheduled them, including Telford, because that was nearly sold out, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there wasn't many tickets left. So when we do it next time, it'll be absolutely rammed, I would think.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, well, I've got my ticket ready to go to go back. All fingers crossed, and think, you know, obviously things plan out the way we hope, like you say, with numbers falling and you know, new medicines. Fingers crossed, it will get better. But it's got to be the biggest. Obviously, in the 25 years that you guys have been around, I'm guessing there's always ups and downs in anyone's career or tenure. This has got to be the biggest road bump that you guys have ever come across.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, we've managed to continue to tour almost all of that 25 years. You know, we started off in Glastonbury, as we all know, 25 years ago yesterday, and that tour, and then later that year we started touring commercially in a big top. Then within a couple of years we went over to Germany and South America and performed in arenas. Then came back from that into the roundhouse in London, and so it was non-stop really. We had one little gap. I suppose it would be for, it wasn't long, it was less than, I think about 8 months when we didn't do the full tours. We turned it into a university touring show. And right. So we did big university tours instead of taking a commercial risk in theatres. But that was only because we hadn't done a theatre show and we were in production to do that. And it takes a while to do theatres. You can't suddenly say, I'm going to do a theatre next week. You know, yeah, course, and a university might book you with 2 months ago. A theatre will book you a year in advance. So when we finished at the Roundhouse, we made the decision within a few months to do a theatre production, but it took nearly a year to get it together. But in the interim, I was doing loads of TV shows then. So I still carried on doing all of those, and I still did loads of universities and corporate gigs. And then, you know, the year later, we then started the Sex Wars in theatre, but it's been non-stop, and so we've never had anything like this really.
No, it's total unknown ground, I guess. I'm glad you brought up TV actually, and obviously theatre as well. There's two big points that I wanted to bring up. TV, you did things like, you know, Don't Try This at Home, Saturday Night Takeaway. A lot of people will know you from Britain's Got Talent. Is it a very different kind of atmosphere bringing your kind of show to TV in studios, or whether it be live audiences as well? It's got to be quite a different dynamic to what you do at festivals and theatres.
Well, it is, yeah. I mean, when we first started in TV shows, almost as soon as we started, I remember doing Glastonbury the first time and Sky News did a feature on it. So it just shows you they picked up on it immediately.
Yeah.
And once we'd started touring it commercially, like the next one was in Brighton, which was in November of that same year, and we were doing documentaries. We did a documentary with Danny Bear, but they were all getting showed. And if we did little news clips, they were always the "and finally" bits on the news. So we'd done something crazy and something stupid, and finally the Circus Wars had gone and done this, and here we were. So we got the "and finally" bits on all the news programs. And then when they did the documented Danny Bear thing, that was meant to be screened, I think, about 7:30 in the evening on Channel 4. And they ended up putting it to 9:30 because they obviously thought what we did was a bit more risky. But that all changed when we started doing Don't Try This at Home.
Yes.
That was a thing, you know, we did. I was on it nearly every week. And they actually offered me a part in it at one point. Davina McCall was the main presenter.
Yeah.
And they wanted this mad doctor to do this sort of weird thing, like, you know, coming out with weird cures for things, like putting leeches on people and looking up in history about this and this. And they wanted me to front that because they'd had action search for us so many times. And anyway, I was going to do it, and then they decided to go for an actor instead and went for one they called Dr. Don't instead of Dr. Hayes. But if ever you look at any reruns of Don't Try This At Home, see Dr. Don't, that should have been me. That was going to be me. But anyway, I didn't fall out with them because I was still supplying acts. And, you know, we had things like Sword Swallowers and Human Pincushions on TV with 80 million viewers at 7:30 at night on a Saturday, which is phenomenal. They all thought that wouldn't happen, and it did. And it, people weren't as offended, although we lived in a PC world, you know, a Tony Blair era. He was very much, people weren't as offended as they thought they would be.
Yeah.
So consequently, we from all of that is how we got offered a lot of others. And Ants and Dex Saturday Night Takeaway was part of the producers who did Don't Try This At Home. Some of those had gone into a new show and then asked us to do that. So we did Ant and Dec, and that was good fun. I enjoyed that. And then a couple of years later, they started this new program called Don't Try This At Home. And I beg your pardon, Britain's Got Talent.
Britain's Got Talent,
and,
yeah.
I was in America, and again, the same producer rang me up and said, hey, we've got this new program coming up. Would you be interested in doing it? It's primetime TV, Saturday night. And I said, yeah, well, that sounds interesting. I said, as long as the money's okay, and you know, I'd definitely be interested. And they said, oh, there is no money. It's like a talent show. And I thought, what? And she said, but the thing is, you could win £500,000 if you win it, and I'm sure people will love you. And she said, it's going to be hosted by Paul O'Grady. Anyway, that got shelved. And they started in America first.
Yeah.
And then the English took over, Simon Cowell, as we all know, and used Anton Deck to present it. Mm-hmm. And then every year they used to ring me up and ask me to go on it. And I kept saying no because I didn't want to do it. And then all of a sudden, it was December one year, and I got this email from Talkback Thames, which said, please, can you give me the PR contact for the Circus of Horrors? So I thought, oh, that's good. Somebody may want to do a documentary about it. So, I said, it's me, Dr. Hayes is my number. Then the next day, I got a call from this lady, and she said, oh, it's Britain's Got Talent. And I thought, oh, God, you've got me.
So got me. They've cornered the phone you there.
Instead of on it. Yeah. And she said, well, why do you want to do it? And I said, well, I said, I'll give you a few reasons. I said, one, you're not going to say it's the Circus of Horrors. You're going to say it's John from Preston. Mm. Number two, there's no money. And number three, we might get humiliated. The judges could say that, you know, they could make ruin our career. They could say it's rubbish. So I said, those are three very good reasons for not wanting to do it. And she said, well, look, let me talk to the producer and I'll come back to you tomorrow. So that's what she did. Rang me back the next day and said, look, you can do it as a Circus of Horrors, no problem. You can play your own music, no problem. So you can do it with original music. Because if you look at Don't Tell Us, Britain's Got Talent, I beg your pardon, they very rarely use original music. It's nearly always covers. Well, the first thing, I insisted on using original music, so they allowed us to do that. And they said, you could get humiliated, we won't deny that, but it's very, very unlikely because the judges tend to pick on the acts that aren't very good, and you've got a quality act. So,
of course, yeah.
What I did, I spoke to all the artists, and I said, look, if you want to do it, we can do it. If some of you want to do it, we can do it with some of you, but I'm not making any of you do it. And they all wanted to do it. So so we rehearsed one piece, went down and did it, I think it was 9 years ago now. And they fitted the auditions in all around us, because they call it auditions, but you're really invited onto the show.
You're sort of like poached out of it.
So we were playing in Stoke one night, and then the next day we stayed in Birmingham, but we were performing in Hereford. And in the theatre we normally play in Birmingham, the Alexander, was where they were filming Britain's Got Talent.
Yes.
So we stayed there. The ones of us who were going to appear on Britain's Got Talent went over and did what they call the audition, while the rest of the crew went over to Hereford and built the setup.
Crikey.
And then I said, look, the only way we can do it is if we go on first and we've got to have a dressing room. Nobody else had dressing rooms. So I said, look, we're not being prima donnas. But, you know, we got a lot of us, and you've got intricate things like hair hanging going on.
Of course.
You've got to tie it in a certain way, and, you know, there's secrets to it. I don't want everyone to see how you do it. So they agreed to all that. So we went in through a back door rather than the front, where all the queues were for all these so-called auditionees. Mm-hmm. And then they smuggled us in, took us through the back. Then we stood in this sort of fake queue and signed in. And then did our interviews with Anton Deck, went and did the show, first one on. Got a standing ovation. If you're still on YouTube now, and if you look at it, you can see the standing ovation. But that standing ovation in real life happened for about 5 minutes.
Wow.
The audience were going crazy. So obviously they give us three yeses, as it was three judges at the time. And then, you know, our profile did grow. I think the next ones I didn't really enjoy, to be honest. I didn't enjoy any of them, but the semi-final in particular was horrible, because the audition bit, as they call it, they film it on multiple cameras, and then they edit it.
It's all editing.
But when they do it on a live situation, the big problem is, if it's an act like a singer standing in the middle singing, it's quite easy for them to film it.
Of course.
But when it's something like us, where you've got two aerial acts going on at the same time and loads of stuff going on the floor, and you've got to, you need somebody like Sky cameramen or something who are used to moving from one piece of action to the other. And sadly, they didn't have that. And so in the semi-finals, it was too much long shots. As far as the audience were concerned, they were not the TV audience. They were shooting from distance all the time rather than getting the close-ups. And, you know, if somebody's sword swallowing, you want a close-up of it. If somebody's throwing knives on a revolving board, you want to see those knives hitting the board around the girl. And, you know, a lot of this sadly wasn't happening because they were missing it and it was going out live, so they couldn't re-edit.
Of course. And if you've only got so much time as well, and you want to be able to, you know, other acts, they might go in and it's just a no throw or just a trapeze act or something, but you guys are a whole cocktail of ingredients to bring on a show. You've got to cram it all in, and you know, you've got to stand where they tell you to stand, and you've got to make sure you do it all in so long. You know, what else did they expect other than, you know, a mass parade of loads of stuff going on at once? So
I know, and the other thing they did is I used one of my songs and they rearranged it, which was okay, and I sang live and everything. But what they did is they gave me a version of it and we rehearsed to it, and then we went into the studio to do it, and they gave us another rehearsal in the studio, and suddenly it all fell apart in the middle. Choreography wise, and the reason was because they'd added a bit in middle eight and hadn't told me. So all of a sudden we'd choreographed all this act and had given the producer a list of what's going to happen at what point of the song, and they changed a bit of the song without telling me. So when we went to do it, there was bits in the middle that were out of sync, so we had to quickly re-choreograph. You know, it's not that easy with 20 odd people.
No, 100%. That's crazy. And to think, you know, it's these big TV programs that sort of, as a consumer, myself as an audience member, the less I know about it, the more magical it is on telly. You know, it's all sort of, you know, in quotation marks, faked in a certain way. But I know a few people that have been on, you know, on Britain's Got Talent or America's Got Talent and whatnot. And you're right, they could do an act and they change the music in post anyway. So, you know, it's not true to the actual performance.
No, I've seen people do that. I've seen people go on there and do it.
Yeah.
And then when they've shown them on telly, they've completely changed the music. The music they performed to wasn't on there.
Yeah.
And luckily, we didn't get that. I'm not saying they were bad to us or anything. And it certainly increased our profile without any doubt, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
So with that in mind, I'm glad we did it. But as far as being, you know, doing a piece that you're not 100% happy with because of circumstances, and then having to stand in front of a group of judges who are judging you, and they do, you know, like you say, where they tell you where to stand, they do tell you where to stand, absolutely.
Yeah.
But then if you look at Amanda, whatever her name is,
Amanda Holden,
Holden, her comment, she said, you should look at your positioning. I wanted the right to reply, and I just thought, if I reply to some of the comments they're making, it's going to sound like sour grapes, but I really wanted to, because they actually told us to stand where we stood, so it wasn't our decision. And the reason they told us is because they wanted to make a TV show as opposed to a show for four judges.
Yes. Oh, 100%. I know an artist who, she's a Pink cover artist that does the pubs and clubs. She was told to go on there and do a Pink song, and they ripped into her for doing a Pink song.
I know.
And it's like, well, you can't win. You can't win.
No.
But, it, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I know a few people that, you know, for yourself as well, it's worked, because, like you say, it's only... it's brought you to another audience, I guess. If anything, it's a big, good PR stunt, isn't it?
Well, for us, it's increasing our profile, and what I sort of said is we're taking the extra into the mainstream. We yes. didn't cut, we obviously didn't do Danny with his Hoover on there, but we did do, you know, lots of sword swallowing and dangerous acts and all this sort of stuff. We did it to our own music, and you know, we didn't hold back in that respect. So you know, and the quote taking the extra into the mainstream, I think, is good, because we proved that, you know, you can go on a program like that and gain a lot of new fans. So if you go to one of our shows now, you'll see a massive mixture of people. Yes. You know, you'll see your rock fans who, and since we've been doing Download, you see a lot more metal fans than we did before because of doing Download. When we first started, it was all goths and punks. And then, you know, we were in London for such a long time at the beginning, in the Roundhouse, that started getting, you know, other people started coming along, people who would like Rocky Horror, for example, generally not people from normal walks of life, who wanted to dress up. And so we started getting that sort of audience. And then when we did Download, we started getting the metal fans all coming.
Yes.
And so now we get this big amalgamation, all these different genres of people who seem to love the Circus of Horrors.
Yeah, definitely, which has got to be great as well, from different, like we mentioned earlier, age groups as well, the people who are watching you on Don't Try This at Home, and then like you say, 9 years ago at Britain's Got Talent, and it's, you know, you guys are huge. You know, I remember when I watched you at the Civic in Wolverhampton, really big a big venue, not a single seat left in the house. It was great. The performance is what I love as well. Obviously, it's great seeing you guys on TV, because again, you know, once you're on TV and you know, the clips go on YouTube and things can blow up and hundreds and thousands and millions of people can watch you. But there really is something about watching stuff live, isn't there? Actually seeing it in front of your very eyes. Is that, obviously, you working with an audience from, you know, the age of 11, 12, is that something that's really sort of in your blood, being able to perform in front of a live audience?
It is for me, yes, because you know, what you have to do is you have to stand on stage and you have to look them in the eye, basically. You have to, you know, do the old evangelist thing where they think you're talking to them directly. Mm-hmm. And if you look straight, you can't often see who you're looking at.
Of course.
Because the lights are in your eyes. But you're looking into the crowd and you're pointing at people. You don't actually who you're pointing at very often. Mm-hmm. And the people you're looking at think you're talking directly to them. You know, as a lot of good performers, sort of strippers do it. If you know, good strippers in a strip club will look, they'll be really humiliated, but looking you straight in the eye, and they're just performers, really. And there's loads of people. And Tony Blair, and you know, he would go along on his bus, and he'd be on TV and everything. He'd be pointing up at the top of a house and stuff like that, top of housing, and there's nobody there. But the TV see him pointing up there, and they automatically think, oh, look, he's pointing at these guys there, and nobody there. You know, he just had this, he was taught by, you know, different people, spin doctors and all that, of how to do it. And I wasn't really taught. I just sort of learnt it by performing myself. And, you know, when you see the Circus of Horrors, stuff like sword swallowing, for example, there's only 80 sword swallowers in the world.
Wow.
So to actually see a sword swallower right in front of you, swallowing everything from the leg of a chair to a litany on tube to a curved cutlass, it's quite amazing, you know. I stand next to him, and I have to try and, what I always try and do, and I always try and tell our artists to do the same thing, because I'm no actor and I don't pretend to be an actor, but what I always tell them to do is try and put yourself in a position where you've never seen this act in your life. Mm-hmm. And you stood right next to it and you've seen it for the first time. And the expressions on your face, I don't want false expressions. I don't want any forced acting. But I want the expression on your face to say you've never seen it before. And if you do that, then the audience will pick up on that. So I always tell my artists to do that. We tend to, you know, we have choreographed pieces in the show and everything, and bits where people have to act. But they're very often not actors. So rather than trying to train them to be actors, because I can't do that, it's you train them to
react,
act in a way they would do if that happened in real life.
Yes.
If you know what I mean.
Absolutely. It's a bit like a weird analogy, but when I watch a wrestling match, a move looks so much bigger because the referee has gone, oh my God, they did that. And
it's, again,
they know what's going to happen. They've seen it a million times before. So you guys, you know, you've seen it night after night when you're on these long tours. But it's all about that reaction, which is only going to make an audience, it just builds their reaction as well, doesn't it? It just brings it all full circle.
Yeah, it does. It absolutely does that. If they say you're having a good time and you're looking straight at them and you're referring to them in the crowd and everything, then, you know, it just builds. I mean, when we do Telford, I often do a little, you know, we'll do something about somewhere local, so it'll be Broseley and Telford, because it's just, it sounds a funny place, and I lived there for a while, so I just said Broseley. And we'll always try and pick on something local and something topical at time to integrate into the show. And I think that helps to get your audience with you. Again, like a good comedian would. Good comedians will always look them in the eye, you know, and they talk. I don't like going to comedy because it's so scary and get to look at you.
But really,
they probably can't even see you half the time, like I can't.
Yeah.
They're just talking to a mass in the crowd, then, and you automatically think they're talking to you.
Absolutely. It also adds another dynamic, especially with a show such as the Circus of Horrors, which is quite macabre, and it's an Artodian style of theatre, in the fact that it's quite impactful on the senses, as in mainly visual and sound, especially with the music, and especially seeing Clem Hamerto put, you know, a neon pipe down his throat, or, you know, all the crazy different acts you've had. But if there's a point where you're looking at an audience member, or, you know, there's a certain point where you have audience member come up on stage, and I've tried to strangle Captain Dan with a rope before. It was part of the show, I promise. It was part of the show. I didn't just find him afterwards. but it does add that extra element of a good fear, like a tingly excitement fear, because you go into a show, but it is still that dark, twisted, spooky, camp, even, you know, with Camp Dracula.
Yeah, absolutely camp, yeah.
You have all those different elements, so when that fourth wall can be broken, which you can't get, like I say, with a telly or YouTube and whatnot, when you're watching it live, that fourth wall, even if it's only broken at certain points within your performance, it still gives the audience that, it just gives them more to sort of feed off, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and we do, as you know, it's very interactive and immersive, so we do have artists and performers coming through the crowd at different points and things. And I think that's all important as well, because they then, you know, even right at the beginning of the show, when we do the announcement and say the show will be performed on above the stage and amongst the audience, you hear a groan in the audience, because they're thinking, oh God,
why did I come? You know, why did you drag me here?
But it's the same as if you go into a scare attraction, you go into a maze, you know full well that people are going to be there to scare you and everything. And we try and do it in a funny way, really. We try and, the whole show is meant to be performed with a fork, tongue firmly in each cheek.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And there's always sort of like that false ending as well, where it ends on a really big high and you have the pyro and you shout from hell and we're all putting our devil horns up. And then all of a sudden there'll be someone in the back singing, look on the bright side of life as people are leaving the audience. So, it's all tongue-in-cheek. Speaking of the performance and a live performance, obviously you guys don't rest on your laurels. You're always working when there's no bloody coronavirus around, but you're always on the road. Each year you're doing a different tour, and it always has a slightly different theme, or very different themes. I've seen a carnival, I've seen zombies, I've seen... obviously, there's the 25th anniversary. It's got to be difficult, especially when you have each year maybe different acts sort of come and go, when you have different themes and different stories to tell. How does that creative process sort of plan out? Because it's got to be a difficult one.
Yeah, but if you get the title right, you can work from that, really. Like zombies were very... I used to thought loads of people like zombies. Let's do a show called The Night of the Zombie, and it worked really well. It was very, it's very arty how we did it. We had stuff on the screens, and then those people on the screens would arrive in the crowd and stuff like this. So it was, and everybody was not zombies at the beginning of the show, and then as the show progressed, everybody got turned into zombies.
Yeah.
So that's how we did that one. Next year's new production, when it will start, I don't know, but we're doing two different shows. We're going to do a continuation of the 25th anniversary, but calling it Revamped and Rocking, because just to prove we're back, really, and it'll be like the 25th anniversary, but with new stuff, because I can't just drop that, because obviously, for example, people in Telford book their tickets to go and see the 25th anniversary. If I go there with a different show, it wouldn't be fair.
So what
we're going to do is a revamped version of the of the 25th anniversary tour, like a greatest hits, really. And then once we've been to all the theatres that we would have done on that tour, then we're going to change it, and the next theme is going to be called The Witch.
Awesome.
And it was some fans at the show was saying, "Oh, what's your next thing going to be called?" And I said, "I don't know. I can't think about it yet." And they said, "You haven't tried witches yet." And I thought, "That's a good idea." So I worked out an illusion where we can do a burning at the stake, because I think that's vital if you do a witch thing. So we're going to do a big burning at the stake in it. We're going to have a Ouija board. We've used a Ouija board before, so we're going to do that again and have people coming climbing through the Ouija board, performers and stuff like this, and climbing through different parts of the set. So we're going to have stuff like that. And I don't know what what part of which, but I'm going to look at Salem or what. I'll just study different things, really, I'd love to go to America, to Salem, and have a look at the Witch Museum and things over there. I watch witch movies and stuff and think about things that can incorporate and write a few new songs, and some of the songs we have done before, like Heresy Files, will fit straight into thing, and so will Voodoo, and you know, From Hell, they'll all fit into the witch scenario. So I'll just rewrite some songs and I'll write a few new ones. So next year will be a bit of a mixture of things. It'll start off with one show and then morph into another one once we've done all the ones that we should have already done, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah, no, absolutely, definitely. It's cool to think, because obviously creating a show, a performance, is no easy task, especially when, like I say, you've got different acts to come in on stage and take them off and whatnot, and you've got to have a finale, you know, middle, beginning and end, and end it on a high with the finale. So it's cool that you know, once you've got your theme, you sort of work from the top of the pyramid and then fill in all the gaps as you move down, really, when it comes to music, then what acts are going in where and how the story can progress. So, and that's what I think keeps your show so fresh as well. You know, 25 years, you know, a long time, but it's always felt fresh because you'll ever see new acts, or the acts I have seen before are more gruesome or more crazy, or, you know, it's at a different point in the show. For some reason, you know, 1 minute I'm watching Hannibal put down a neon tube, but then the next minute there's a chair of the leg going down his throat. It just adds all those dynamics. Speaking of the neon tube, that's I don't always like to bring up the accidents and things like that, but it's dangerous if you don't know what you're doing, sort of business, isn't it, really? You guys obviously very safe, and over the years only very, very few accidents I guess have happened, but is that something that's always a little bit at the back of your mind, like, we've got to be safe here, we've got to be careful, because, you know, shit can happen?
Well, shit does happen. It's everything is risk assessed, and we try and do it, you know, the safest way you possibly can do it, but because you are doing dangerous things, there is, you know, it's a calculated risk, but that risk is still there.
Yeah.
And as you say, we've had funny accidents, you know, with Captain Dan getting his part of his anatomy caught in a Hoover. That was one of the funny ones. And but we had a couple of bad ones with helmets. When he, first of all, he swallowed he swallowed a sword, pushed it a bit too far, cut a hole on the inside of his throat at the top of his esophagus. Carried on, didn't feel too well though, and then the next morning woke up and his neck had swollen up to the size of his head, and so they took him to hospital, and he was in hospital for a while. But then a few years later, 2 or 3 years later, he decided then to start swallowing the neon tube. And in the show I say the neon tube is the most dangerous thing ever swallowed by any short swallower, and it really is, because you've got poisonous fluid running through it, it's covered in glass, and it's powered by electric. So if it did break inside you, one of the three elements would get you.
Mm.
So you've got to make sure it doesn't break. That is the crucial thing. And what he was doing, he had a very thin plastic sleeve put over the top of it to stop it cracking. Anyway, we noticed a crack in it, in the plastic tube.
Yeah.
So we thought, oh, that doesn't look good. We better send that back. So we sent it back to the manufacturers to remake it. They sent another one back, and they made it slightly wider. And none of us realized. Hannibal didn't notice it. I didn't notice it. So he started to swallow it in the show and was doing it for a while and must have got some sort of throat infection. Maybe his throat had swollen up a little bit. And it was on the eve of Halloween, actually, 30th of October. I can't remember what year. And we were on the stage in Bradford, and he swallowed the neon and pushed it a bit too hard. Wow. And it cut a hole inside his esophagus further down. And so after the show, he didn't feel too well. And he said to me, have you got any Gaviscon? Because I get dodgy tummy sometimes. So I said, yeah, but I don't think it's Gaviscon. You need
something more than Gaviscon, yeah.
But that didn't do the trick. So we chucked in the back of my car with his wife, and we drove around the streets of Bradford trying to find the hospital. And every light was red when you got to it, and he was getting worse and worse in the back. We thought, oh, shit, this is not good. Anyway, we got into the hospital. You had to make sure we kept him awake and walked him in. And then they wouldn't believe he was a sword swallower. but he had in his pocket a credit card type thing which said he's a member of the International Sports Swallowers Association. So right. He took him for an x-ray and found that he had quite a big gap in his esophagus further down. And what was happening, the stomach acid was going through the gap. Wow. And going round his lungs and round his heart. So they had to put him on an induced coma to let that and feed him intravenously and things.
Wow.
And make him breathe intravenously until it could repair itself. They could have cut him open and stitched it all up, but they didn't really want to do that.
Mm.
So they let nature take its course and repair itself, which it did, thankfully.
Yeah.
But he was in hospital for 6 weeks, 2 weeks in intensive care. Then he was released, and then a month later he started sword swallowing again.
If that isn't getting back on the horse, I don't know what is.
No, but the thing is, they always say you learn by your mistakes, and in his case, he certainly did, because you know the mistake was obvious once he'd done it, and that was the sword was too wide for him. So now we know the width of swords you can swallow, that shouldn't be a thing we have again.
Yes,
that should
of course.
Be something we can overcome now, because he knows he has to swallow. And when I see sort of rookie sword swallowers learning to sword swallow, I'll very often look at the size of the sword and say, I think that's too wide for you. Do it with something narrower to start with and get yourself going on something like that, because it's a horrible thing to learn sword swallowing. You're being sick all the time.
Yeah.
It's really unpleasant. But some people can do it, and... as I say, when some people do it, you look at what they're doing it with and you're thinking, that's a bit too dangerous. And because we've learned now, you know, we know really the right way to do it.
Of course, yeah, definitely. It's a very different career choice than being a German tax inspector, isn't it? It's...
Yeah, which is what he was originally. When he first saw the Circus of Horrors, he was worked in a Sonathan in Germany, and he just left that and started a piercing company in a market stall.
Okay.
And we were performing in Tollwood Festival, which was a month long, and he loved the Cirque du Soleil. He came every night to see it. He didn't have one visible tattoo or piercing in them days.
Right.
And within after we went from Germany, I didn't see him again. 10 years later, he turned up at a show in London, and he completely modified his body. He was from head to foot tattooed.
Wow.
His tongue was fought like a serpent. He had replaced some of his teeth with 40,000-year-old mammoth ivory, and he'd sword swallow.
Yeah.
So he was a perfect reborn freak.
Yeah, absolutely. Fair, but you hear about born-again Christians, he's a born-again freak, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love that, absolutely. And he's been with you ever since, which is great, and I'm glad that, like I say, it's a bit mad that someone who tears their esophagus... What everyone's missed is that you say he carried on to the end of the show. He just, you know, he didn't run off stage he carried on.
He knew he wasn't quite right, but he didn't know what he'd done.
Right.
So he just carried on performing. And then at the end of the show, you know, we started what we call the pull down, getting it all loaded away into the truck. And that's when he came to me and said, I don't feel well.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, God.
Get me to hospital.
And have you got any Gaviscon?
Gaviscon.
I said, yes, but I don't think that's the answer.
Yeah, I was going to say, Gaviscon's not the answer for a sword swallower, and super glue is not the answer for Captain Dan, no, definitely.
Exactly. Yeah, he made that mistake too.
Absolutely. I mean, it's funny you mentioned that. Obviously, when you first met Hannibal Kanamoto, he didn't have the tattoos, and now when he comes on a stage, you introduce him as a walking work of art. He's got some fantastic pieces all over his body. Talking of the last 25 years of you doing the show, times have changed, and just talk about tattoos. People are now got sleeves or full bodies or full legs and whatnot. Have you found that over the years that people have got more or less PC? Have they been less shocked or more shocked? Because everyone's going to be shocked when they go and see your performance. It's just in the nature of the beast of what you guys perform. But do you see a huge change over the last 25 years with your audiences, or is it still, it's to quote your book, mud, blood and glitter, is it still the fact that they all just scare the hell out of people still?
Well, I think I'm the world's only freak because I've got no piercings and no tattoos. So I'm the world's only freak now.
That's a good point.
So, no, you're quite right. I mean, look at footballers. David Beckham, for example, a pillar of the community, and he's covered in tattoos.
Mm.
So it's become acceptable now, that side of things. It's very weird, You still get some theatres. I had one yesterday, and the lady who's at this theatre used to book us when she was in another theatre. She loved the show, and we booked there regular, and we would do very good business for her, and she liked the show. She moved to this other theatre, which we couldn't get into, and I thought, oh, great. I'll get in touch with her now, and we'll hopefully add this one to our itinerary.
Yeah.
And I got in touch with her, and she said, I don't think it's for us. And I said, why? And she said, well, it's the freak bit, the freak show.
Right.
And I thought, how ridiculous is that?
Yeah.
That's really discriminating. They don't 100%. Realize what they're doing. Because, if you look at the Circus of Horrors, we have something like 25 to 28 performers. A quarter of them are not British.
Mm-hmm.
Five of them are black. We have transgender performers. We have gay performers.
Yeah.
We have straight performers. We have people who are, who call themselves born freaks, like little Danny. He was born like that, and he makes the most of his height. He's made a career at the fact that he's a good little actor. And look at Warwick Davis, another one,
exactly.
A great actor.
Yeah.
But they were in Star Wars. He was an Ewok in Star Wars. He was in Labyrinth with David Bowie. He was mm-hmm. in Muppet Treasure Island. This is little Danny I'm talking about now. And he's done all of this. And then every year he really likes going to do his panto because it pays really well. And he really gets annoyed when the panto won't have real dwarves because they think it's politically correct. And instead of that, they'll have kids. And it really annoys him because they're taking his livelihood away.
Yeah.
And he's registered disabled. And so you just... By making a comment like that, you're really discriminating against people like Danny and Helmut, who decided he wanted to make his body look like this.
Yeah.
Nobody made him do it. He saw the Circus Rose and was inspired by it, and then looked at other people and thought, I want to have great big ears, and I want to have a forked tongue, and I want to have floating ribs, and I want to do all this stuff, and it's my body, and that's what I want to do with it. And
and
because he's done all of that, and then they won't allow him to perform, if I'd said to this woman, okay, we'll take all the freak element out and we'll come and we'll do a rock and roll circus for you, she'd have said, fine.
Yeah.
But I'm not prepared to do that.
No,
because that would be turning my back on these people that I love and have been performing with me for years. And, we had a wolf boy with us once. I don't
really
remember
saw him.
That.
Yeah, I saw him.
Yeah, and he was a lovely guy, really nice guy. And he was born with a strange condition, and there's like a family of them where all his face is covered in hair. Mm-hmm. And there hadn't been a wolf boy in the UK for 20 years. And I thought, well, this would be great if I could get this, bring a wolf boy over. And I wanted one that could do something. I didn't want one that just looked unusual. All the artists we've got have got to be good actors or good sword swallowers or be able to do really unique things like Danny opening a beer bottle with his eye socket.
Of course.
All this sort of stuff, it's really unique. I've never seen anybody do that till I saw Danny do it. And he had all this stuff and a great performer. And so that's why I loved him and wanted him to be in the show. And the thing with Chewie, he was a wire walker, and we couldn't really do that in the circus for us because we were performing in theatres.
Mm-hmm.
So what he did, he walked the ladder of swords. Now, you see other people do that, but you watch nearly everybody who does it I've got somebody holding the hands so they can't move back and forth. But because he's a wire walker, he walked them swords with nobody holding him, completely unassisted. If he'd slipped, he would have done himself serious damage. Wow. So he walked up this ladder, one foot after the other, not holding anybody at all, using his own balance to get up there because he was his expert wire walker. And the fact that he had, you know, hair all over his face was brilliant. Mm. He looked great. Now, the thing with him, he tried to work in construction back in Mexico, which is where he came from.
Right.
And he just got the piss taken out of him all the time because of the way he looked. Yet the minute you put him on the Circus Horror stage, he's loved by the audience.
Yeah.
When you bring him out, the audience go crazy. As they do with Little Dan, they love him. Little Dan goes in a kebab shop and you'll get some chavs there taking the piss out of him. But he walks on the stage of the Circus of Horrors, and he's not 4 foot one anymore. He's 10 foot tall.
He's a giant.
Because, you know, the people love him. And this is the big thing. And that, so when theatres make ridiculous comments like that, it really annoys me. And I'll go to the media with it at some point if it carries on, because it's they're really discriminating against people doing jobs in their chosen profession.
Have you found that it's crazy, like I mentioned earlier, with it being spanning over the 25 years of times has changed and whatnot, it seems that we can go so far one way, but then so far backwards the other way. You know, when we talk with tattoos, like, you know, my wife's got loads of tattoos, and I know people with loads of tattoos all over them. Like you say, David Beckham, great example, pillar of the community, and now he's covered in tattoos. 20 years ago, that might have been very different. So we're more understanding about certain types of things, but then other sort of things are going beyond politically correct, and people are scared to be offended or say anything, or be very snowflakey about it. It's crazy.
And, you know, you worry about what you put in a show, because we've got black people in the show, and you're wondering, am I doing anything that might seem offensive to them? But you think, hang on, them guys aren't offended by it. They love it.
Of course.
They love being in the Circus of Horrors. They don't want to work for any other circus. That is their main goal. You know, they want to do the Circus of Horrors. Every day I'm getting them ringing me up from Tanzania, or emailing me, or Facebook messaging me saying, look, when can we come back? And I'm saying, well, you know, as soon as I can, lads, you know.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, you're thinking about it almost, it's weird. It's making you almost question yourself sometimes.
Yeah.
And,
second guessing all the time.
Yeah. And you mustn't do that, because your instincts are probably right. You know, when people say that they're offended by this act or that act or something, it's probably them that are wrong, not you, because we are the most equal opportunity employer probably in the world.
Yeah, 100%.
It doesn't matter what you look like, how big you are, how small you are, how beautiful you are, how ugly you are, it makes no difference whatsoever. We'll enhance that if you've got a real talent.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. It's the most equality show you can get, isn't it, really?
Yeah, when you look at it, we have beautiful girls, we have good-looking guys, and we have weird-looking people who like to look weird.
Yeah, who have made themselves specifically look that way because that's what they want to do. It is crazy, and it's a scary, crazy world. But, you know, I think, hopefully, for the most part, we are talking about a minority, because otherwise you wouldn't have, you know, sell-out shows and the tours you have.
Most theatres, when theatres have had us, I mean, this particular theatre have never booked us before. It's just a shame that this lady, who was really lovely, you know, and as I said, booked us regularly for the other theatre. I feel a bit sad for her, because obviously somebody's saying to her, you can't do this because of this. And I wish they'd sort of let me talk to this person who is coming up with this ridiculous, ridiculous ban.
Yeah.
Because that's what it is, really.
Yeah.
And they're stopping the people of Doncaster, because that's where it is. They're stopping people of Doncaster going to see a show that they may really like to see, because somebody there has got some mad preconception about the show that they really don't know what they're talking about. Rocky Horror Show not long ago, well, say not long ago, 40, 50 years ago, would have been really outrageous, and most people probably wouldn't have touched it.
Yeah,
now it's so popular, they'll bite your hand off if you're from Rocky Horror.
Absolutely. I mean, it flopped to start with, and now it's become the cult classic that it is. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's scary, it's mad, but like I say, fingers crossed it will continue to only ever be the minority. People won't be sheep and sort of following that suit. And like you say, I mean, I see your tour schedule, and it is a gruesome one, isn't it? You're going from town to town to city to city. Does it get? I mean, it's got to be something you love. You wouldn't have done it for so long if you didn't. But each and every night, when do you move after the show? Do you travel then? Do you travel in the daytime after?
It's real Groundhog Day. You do. You get up in the morning. You drive to the theatre from whatever hotel you're staying in. Mm-hmm. We get in at 12 o'clock. We put the set up. Everybody helps. It's not like any other theatre production where you've got six or so roadies or stage crew putting all the set up and all the actors go and sit in the dressing rooms. That doesn't happen with us. Mm-hmm. Everybody helps. So we all go and help, put the set up, build it all up, as we call it. Then we leave it to the technical people, like the lights and sound, to work in the afternoon to get all that sort of things working.
Yeah.
And then at 5 o'clock, we have a meeting every day. So we sit everybody down in the seats. And we go through last night's show, the previous night's show, to discuss anything that went wrong or was good, and we want to do it even better. And then we'll look at the venue we're in, and we'll say, right, we've got to do this a bit different here, because there's not as much room on that side of the stage, or you can't get in through that door, so if you're coming through the crowd, you've got to be careful how you get there. So we'll go through all of this sort of stuff, and then we'll have a sound check, and then we'll get ready for the show, do the show, straight after the show, pull it all down, load it back into the truck, drive. That normally takes maybe 2 hours. The truck then heads off with a couple of minibuses, and we'll then head for the a travel lodge or whatever en route to the next theatre. So if we're playing in Telford one night and we're going to be in Cardiff the next, we might say, all right, we'll stay somewhere like Gloucester or something en route.
Yeah.
So we'll drive down, stop there, go to bed at whatever time we get there, get up a few hours later and do the whole thing again.
Wow. It's got to be a logistical nightmare sometimes.
Yeah, it's really, if the trucks break down, it's a nightmare. Yeah. But if you can avoid that, then it's all right. And we all get on well, you know. There's no massive egos. Everybody's got an ego. There's nothing wrong with that. But there's no really big, nobody with massive egos. And everybody gets on well with one another. And nobody fights with one another. And it's... you know, it's quite a nice crowd. We have a good laugh, really, and we'll party together. If we have nights off, we'll all go and have a drink together or whatever. You know, and it's a good crew, and most of the ones who work with me have worked with me for years, one way or the other, and some leave and then come back. And there's not many that go and don't want to come back or leave on bad terms. That's really unusual. It's nearly always...
positive.
Yeah, always positive, yeah.
That's great. Yeah, I think you can always tell when you see you guys. Obviously, you do your meets and greets as well. Like you have the photos afterwards, and you have usually the girls selling the program at the beginning, and it's always friendly, and it's great because obviously it's a circus, it's horrors, it's all spooky, it's crazy, it's a little bit off the wall, but it's always nice to see that there's a personal side to you all as well when you come out for photos afterwards and whatnot. So
yeah, well, we try and make it an experience, you say. Yeah, from the minute you walk in, so we don't like the normal usherettes in the theatre would just start the program and, you know, they wouldn't really know what they're doing. They wouldn't have any banter with anybody. But if you've got a few of the performers there that people might recognise, selling the programmes and on the merchandise stall, that's always a great thing. And then we have weird characters wandering around amongst them. And, you know, building, having a bit of banter, having a bit of fun. And then they go into the auditorium. It's always very smoky and very dimly lit. We try not to have really bright house lights. We try and dimly lit it. And we've got Gregorian chants going through the sound system as they're coming in, and we're trying to create an atmosphere before the show's even started.
Yes.
And so when it starts, it's like a punch in the face, as you know. And then it's immersive throughout. You don't know what's going to happen and where it's going to happen. And then at the end of the show, you know, we've turned a negative word, which is horror, into a positive word.
Yes.
And people are coming out singing the songs and having a good time and wanting the pictures taken with you and, you know, signing things and you know, going away really on a high. And that, it gives you a great job satisfaction when that happens.
Absolutely. And I think that's why your show with the Circus of Horrors goes quite well as well with, you know, my side of things when I go to lots of scare attractions and theme parks and horror scare experiences and whatnot. Because it's, again, horror is the negative word. It's scary, it's spooky. But what happens when someone gets scared, you laugh at them. Or
absolutely.
If I'm scared, I've laughed at myself. So the when you're actually leaving one of these scare attractions, or when you're leaving an overnight horror experience, or when you're leaving the Circus of Horrors, you're laughing, you're smiling. It's the comedy that comes from all of it, really, which is...
Yeah, and I think you can trace that right back to the Hammer films, really.
Yeah,
absolutely. They were great, but they were always quite hammy and funny as well as being scary, you know. And I think horror did get serious in the 70s, you know, no doubt. I mean, Exorcist haunted me.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
You know, amazing film. And then the slasher films, you know, started with Texas Chainsaw Massacre and all that, and the Saw films and all that. But it was... But generally, it's good to have a bit of humour in there as well. And I think a lot of the scare attractions have cottoned on to that. But yes. You don't want to be just terrifying people and making them cry and upsetting them. You need to make it funny as well and turn that negative word horror into a positive word and make Halloween a time to be celebrated for all of us.
Absolutely. And, you know, I love Halloween. I'd rather have two Halloweens rather than a Christmas, me. It's really something that I live and breathe. I try and do it throughout the whole year, as you know, here with the podcast and whatnot. But it's probably a good way to end this on, really, before we go. I've had a couple of questions on our social media pages. But Circus of Horrors and Scare Attractions, they have had that connection over the years. I know you were at Thorpe Park Fright Nights. You've done multiple Scare Cons, and most recently you're at Shocktoberfest as well, at Tully's Shocktoberfest down in Crawley. And obviously Blackpool Pleasure Beach every Halloween as well. Have you just seen that it's a relationship that's blossomed from the love of horror, the fact that Scare Attractions and Circus of Horrors just fit together so well?
Yeah, I think it's a marriage made in hell, really.
Yeah.
It's you know, we're offering something different to the scare attractions, because rather than just maze after maze after maze after maze, mm-hmm. You know, to have something that is a bit funny, a bit camp, but nevertheless horror, and you sit down and see it, is a really big change from the other ones. And it's been a massive success at Tully's. You know, we've got that big top there that holds 600, and we were supposed to do, I think, 5 shows a day. And the first year we were doing it, it got so popular we started doing 7 shows a day.
Wow.
And then we went back last year, and they opened Tully's as a daytime spook attraction as well.
Yeah.
And we ended up doing 4 extra shows, family-friendly extra shows, during the day. So we did that. So, you know, we had to have two sets of artists.
Yeah.
So some would do the daytime and some would do the evening. Some would do both, believe it or not, wanted to do all of it. But some just did the afternoons and some did the evenings. But it was, you know, it was it just proves the popularity of it. And the afternoon ones, even when, you know, there's kids in, they were full as well. And when we did Blackpool last year, we used to do, we did mainly shows in the evening. And there were proper 2-hour shows there, whereas Tully's is 25 minutes or something like that, you know. But these were big 2-hour shows. So, you know, they had to be good value for money and everything. So we used to do an afternoon show sometimes, like a 5 o'clock and then an 8 o'clock. And we did them, it was the same show, basically.
Yeah.
So the afternoons were never that busy, and the evenings were always very busy. And then what we did last year, we thought, right, let's try and make it adult family friendly and cut out the nudity and cut out the swearing, but still have all the shocks and surprises and all the big circus acts and the music. And we did that, and we found that the afternoon shows doubled the capacity. We were actually doubling what we had in. So it's also proving to me that kids love the Circus of Horrors too, but they can't necessarily go. And I don't want to take the edginess away. I don't want to take, you know, I don't want it so there's no nudity or no swearing. I want it so you can add that into it, as you would in comedy. But if you can do it without as well and make it family friendly, then that's what we try and do. And so we do... not many, but throughout the year we'll do a few that are family-friendly versions.
Yeah. And then I suppose it's just it's without watering down your product to the adult audiences when you perform those shows. I suppose it means that kids can get a glimpse of what they can see in a few years' time as well.
Yeah, exactly. At some Tully's, you know, we have to sort of find a halfway house there in the evening shows. Because, again, they're not paying to come in. They're paying to come into the whole attraction. The Circus of Horrors is an added bonus to them.
Yeah.
So you don't want people not liking it because it's gone too far one way with swearing or something. So we try and curtail it a bit in Tully's, but not too much. You know, the evening ones are still quite full on, but not probably as much as the adult shows that you would see in a theatre.
And I got that when I watched the show as well. It's again, it's such a great atmosphere to not only have scare mazes, which I love going to, but now Scream Parks are adding that extra element, like you say, to have a... It's one thing having a stage with some bands on, which Tully's have had for years. They actually had two the last 3 years. And now to then, on top of that, have a proper sit-down theatrical space, it's a great extra dynamic. And obviously the Circus of Horrors are perfect for that location.
Yeah, and we love it, and we really like Stuart and his family. And
yeah,
you know,
great.
They're
team.
Really nice people. Yeah, you couldn't meet nicer people, to be honest. And we'll often have a chat about the world and things like that, and you know, and about what's going to happen. And you know, we're always very positive, and we like working together. We love working with them, and they seem to love working with us.
Yeah, perfect. Again, another match made in hell. Perfect.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before we sort of finish this, and again, thank you so much for coming on. I really do appreciate it. We said on our Instagram that we're going to be interviewing tonight, and we got a few questions. First one's from Dawood, who said, over the 25 years, have you got an act that you've had on your show that is one of your, I'm not going to say the favourite, because then, you know, you'll have the rest of your team having a go at you going, why wasn't I your favourite? But is anything, you know, really stands out to you to think, wow, that's a feat, that's crazy that someone could do something like that, or someone is that way? Is anything jump out at you?
And we've had a few like that, really. I think one, when we were in Russia, we had this two brothers doing this act, mm-hmm. and they were doing like a hand balancing act, so we call it a adagio act, and really very strong and very powerful and great stuff. But then the finale of their act, and it's even, when I describe it, you can't believe what I'm going to say, but it really does happen. They put a dagger in his mouth. Now, we used to have a girl in the show who used to have a dagger in the mouth, and then from the dagger a sword, and then she would walk up a ladder and then come down the other side, balancing the dagger on the sword point to point. That's amazing.
I remember that, yeah.
What this guy did, he had the dagger in his mouth, then he had another dagger, and his partner, who was actually his brother, used to also hold it in his mouth, and he went upside down, and they went they went point to point on the dagger with the guy upside down in his mouth. It was like, you can't believe what you're watching. And it was so that to me was one of the most amazing acts that we've ever had. I've tried to bring it to England, and I'm going to continue. They had a couple of little babies at the time,
right.
Although they loved the show, but absolutely astounding, point to point on the daggers, and one man on one side, one on the other. It was absolutely sensational.
That's incredible. Absolutely, crikey. Yeah, that it sounds almost unbelievable altogether, doesn't it? You think,
yeah,
is that even possible?
Absolutely. And then if you saw it with your own eyes, you're thinking, good God, how the hell can anybody, the strength of the guy holding the one at the bottom, and then the fact that he could slip off and just go straight in you.
Oh gosh, yeah. That's scary. That's going to be one of those performances where I'm sure people are watching through their, you know, through their hands,
yeah,
through their fingers.
Absolutely,
definitely.
Yeah.
Becky Dixon over on our Instagram, she's a makeup artist at York Maze Hallow Scream. She says, do you guys all do your own makeup? Do you have makeup artists? And if you so, can she be one?
Well, I know Becky very well. She's a big fan of the Circus of Horrors.
Perfect.
So hello, Becky. Yeah. I've seen she does great makeup on herself.
Yes.
We do tend to do, if you look on my Facebook sites now, you'll see I'm reminiscing and doing all stuff about the first shows in Glastonbury. Mm-hmm. And when we did those shows, we did actually bring a makeup artist in. You look at my makeup, it's very intricate in those pictures.
Yeah.
And that was actually done by a makeup artist. But the answer now, Becky, is we do it ourselves. I've learned to put the slap on and...
pop it on.
Yeah, so we do it ourselves. But when we're here, come down, and there's certain lads in the show, like the Warriors and the band, will love you to do their makeup for them.
Perfect. Awesome. Just last two questions. One here now is from Callum Beckett. Now, Callum, he's a friend of Scaretrack. He runs an overnight event called Scream Camp, which is a 10-hour-long horror camping experience. He's asking if anyone from Circus of Horrors or the team are into that sort of thing. Would you do something as crazy as a 10-hour overnight horror experience?
When you said, would we do it, would we actually participate?
Or would you be a punter? And I mean, I've done it, and it's absolutely terrifying. So
I probably would, actually. I mean, you know, you always think these haunted houses. I mean, place that's supposedly genuinely haunted. Mm-hmm. Would you ever sleep there? Well, I probably would. Yeah. I slept in a crypt once. It was I did a gig in a church, obviously an old church, and then afterwards they were supposed to provide me accommodation, and what they gave me is the room at the back of the church, which was a crypt. So I had to sleep in this crypt, and there was actually all, not coffins, but, you know, tombs around me, and I slept on a bed with these, surrounded by tombs, on my own, in this crypt. And I probably wouldn't mind staying at a haunted house. Would definitely appeal to me. So I don't know whether I'd like to camp.
And I'm not into camping myself.
No, people waking me up to try to scare me. Yeah. But if it was in a haunted house where it could potentially be haunted and I could sleep there tonight, yeah, I think I'd like that.
Perfect. And our very last question is from Frankie Yates. He says, can I join the circus, please? I can't do a lot, but I could probably fit in the jar. And I know Frankie, she's tiny, so she could fit in the jar. I'm sure there's probably some more criteria that Frankie would need to hit to be able to join the circus.
There is, but if she wanted to be a guest person in a Girl in the Bottle, then we have done that from town to town. So by all means, get in touch with me and we'll... see where she lives and see if we can incorporate her for a night.
Fantastic.
She should be a guest pickled person.
Guest pickled person sounds good. I wish I could be, but I am 6'1" and I can't even touch my toes. So,
okay.
Not happening. I mean, Dr. Hayes, thank you so, so much for coming on to Scare Track. It really, really does mean a lot. Obviously, coronavirus is still around, but as soon as that starts disappearing and as soon as shows can start starting again, where's the best place for people to find out all about the Circus of Horrors on your social media and your website?
Yeah, social media or website, www.circusofhorrors.co.uk, and all the links to social media are from there. I do post every day. I'm posting about 3 times a day now because of the anniversary, but generally I post every day. I mean, we are hoping. We've got nothing planned really now till October, but we have been approached by a major London theatre to do a drive-in Circus of Horrors this summer.
Wow.
So that is something I'm considering doing, but I'm not definitely committing myself to it yet because, again, you need to, how immersive we can make that, I don't know.
Of course.
And there'd have to be big screens and everything, but it might be a novel way of doing it. And, if they would allow me to have a bit of... allow some sort of immersiveness of it, like zombies going around the crowds, the cars or something, then when you're least expecting it, then I think something like that might be great.
Yeah.
So I'm going to certainly consider it, and that might be a way forward, a temporary way forward, until we can get back in theatres, big tops and festivals.
Yeah, absolutely. So keep an eye out for that, especially on your social media. And like Dr. Hayes says, he's on there a lot at the moment, especially celebrating the last 25 years. Dr. Hayes, thank you so much for coming on. A fantastic 25 years, and here's to another 25.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been great.
Perfect. Thank you.
You're listening to Scare Track.
So there we go, folks. A huge thank you to Dr. Hayes from the Circus of Horrors for taking time out of his busy schedule to come here onto the Scare Track podcast. Even though the show's not touring, that guy wears lots of hats within that production, within that business. So he's always, always busy. And so we really appreciate that he's taking time out of his busy schedule to come onto the Scare Track podcast. Myself and Hannah, we are huge fans. Like I said in the interview, we've seen them on multiple stage shows, Download, Bike Fest, ScareCons, Tullish Oktoberfest, even, you know, anywhere we can, we'll try and see the Circus of Horrors. A fantastic show. And if you haven't seen them yet, as soon as COVID-19 and all this palaver is over and we can start watching live music and live theatre again, get your tickets. To keep all up to date, obviously go to circusofhorrors.co.uk. And you can support them now by going to their shop. It's on their main website, or go to shop.circusofhorrors.co.uk and buy a bit of merchandise. The Blood, Mud, Blood and Glitter autobiography of Dr. Hayes' book is on there. I have it. I've had it for years now. I've read it 3 or 4 times. Fantastic read. The music, the iTunes links are all there. Download some of the music, some fantastic songs, some fantastic albums, in fact, and some great merchandise. They always have have some fantastic quality merchandise. They've even got a face mask up there now as well, guys, with fangs. So, yeah, support Circus of Horrors as much as you can. Go to shop.circusofhorrors.co.uk. And whilst you're online, be sure to check out our website, scaretrack.co.uk. On there, we have all our interviews, all our podcasts, scare cams, coaster track, merchandise for us as well. Absolutely everything Scare Track related is over on our website, scaretrack.co.uk. We also have some videos coming out very soon, folks, so make sure you are subscribing to us over on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/scaretrack. And of course, be sure to interact with us over on our social media pages. We are on Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, and Facebook. And of course, make sure you're following Circus of Horrors there as well. We'll put the links in our show notes as well. So that brings us to the end of this episode of the Scare Track Podcast. A huge, huge, huge thank you for everyone listening, and we'll see you soon. Bye, folks.